Good morning. Yesterday, a meeting between US President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. What had been on the agenda? An agreement between the two countries that might have given the US access to valuable mineral resources and for the Ukraine an opportunity to lobby for some security assurances. Fair to say it was not the meeting that had been anticipated.
We're going to feel very good and very strong.
You will feel influenced.
You're right now not in a very good position. You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having cards.
Playing cards.
Right now, you don't have
cards.
You're playing cards. You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
And on Drive Time, just before 6 o'clock, Cormac brought us this.
There's an incredibly tense meeting between Presidents Trump and Zelensky taking place right now in the White House. We're going to play you a clip from it now in the last few moments. Here's President Trump. He says he's not aligned with President Putin.
Well, if I didn't align myself with both of them, you'd never have a deal. You want me to say really terrible things about Putin and then say, hi, Vladimir, how are we doing on the deal? That doesn't work that way. I'm not aligned with Putin. I'm not aligned with anybody. I'm aligned with the United States of America and for the good of the world. I'm aligned with the world.
And in this clip, we'll hear about the casualties of war.
People have been dying on the contact line. Nobody stopped him. You know that we had conversations with him, a lot of conversations, my bilateral conversation, and we signed with him, me, like a new president. In 2019, I signed with him the deal. I signed with him, Macron and Merkel, we signed ceasefire. Ceasefire, all of them told me that he will never go. We signed him with gas contract. Yes, but after that, he broke this ceasefire. He killed our people and he didn't exchange prisoners. We signed the exchange of prisoners, but he didn't do it.
And after that, the Vice President, J.D. Vance, said, I think it's disrespectful for you to come to the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. And that meeting is ongoing, and we'll bring you more a little bit later on in the programme.
And as all of that was unfolding, this live reaction from Ukrainian MP Inés Ovsan.
And President Trump has said in the last few minutes, you either make a deal or we are out.
Well, that's definitely not how the Allies should be behaving. And that's not how the United States were behaving in World War II, when they have provided all the weapons that Europeans needed to be able to fight against great evil of Nazis. And right now, it seems to be that the United States has taken it a different political stance in this conflict. I'm reading the news as we speak.
You're okay, so am I. And perhaps I can read a line or two for our listeners as well. Trump, according to the BBC, has told reporters that NATO and Europe have to step up, in his words. And returning to the US proposed minerals deal, he said, all they talk about is security. I said, let's make a deal first. And he says that the American taxpayer has to be protected. So it seems that he's looking for this. He's looking for your minerals and the resources in the ground in Ukraine before he talks about the security of Ukraine and its people first.
Yeah, but then the question is, why do we need this deal then? What is the angle for us here, right? If we get nothing in exchange, we're just giving up our minerals, which is one of the very few things we have left after this devastating war for 11 years. That just makes very little sense. And if Trump presents himself as a great deal maker, then what is the deal he's offering to Ukrainians?
Well, it seems, based on previous comments, the deal is that this ridiculous war, in his words, will end.
Well, but that's not Ukraine's decision. that is not up for us to decide. The problem is that that Trump again is taking this view that it's Ukraine who wants to continue this war. No, we don't. We are losing people. My son, my friend, a good friend of mine, lost his son today. We are all still shocked. And then reading these comments that it's Ukraine who wants to continue this war. No, it's not. It's terrifying war for us. Yet we are being forced into making a decision as if it was us who started this war, if it's our fault. And without any security guarantees, why would we agree to that? What are we getting out of this? That part I don't understand. That's a very twisted logic I'm hearing.
Yeah.
And Cormac ended the interview with the Ukrainian MP with this question.
Are you afraid of what could happen as a consequence of this meeting in the White House?
Well, I'm trying to think rationally here. Again, we talk as the story develops, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I think that, what I'm trying to figure out is if it ends badly, if they don't make any agreement, if they indeed had a fight altogether, then I think it will be the biggest question then would be what would be European reaction to that?
But also weapons.
Yeah, exactly. But Europe still has weapons that it still can give to Ukraine. Okay. And I think if the EU would choose to act right now, then it will strengthen Ukraine's negotiating position. Because right now, it's us against Donald Trump, against his will to impose this deal on us. If Europe really steps in, then we might have a bit of a leverage in this situation. I think that is where we should think about.
Okay, well, we'll finish your conversation here, but I think...
From Drive Time yesterday evening. And that meeting topped off a week of meetings between Donald Trump and various European leaders, France's Emmanuel Macron and the UK's Keir Starmer. Fair to say, those meetings less fractious, although of course they are not countries at war. And we ourselves got the invitation for the St. Patrick's Day meeting. It's on March 12th. And one thing we hope will not be on the agenda, tariffs. Because on Thursday, Mr. Trump said that he planned to impose a 25% tariff on imports from the European Union, which he accused of being formed in order to screw the United States. With Claire, Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs.
We are very exposed here, aren't we, here in Ireland? I mean, I mentioned that we sell over 70 billion euro worth of goods into the United States. We're more exposed than very many other EU countries.
Well, if you look at it in per person terms, it's about 13,000 euro of goods we shipped over to the US last year for every man, woman and child in the country. Now, that's more than any other European country. And I looked at the data for Mexico and Canada. It's actually higher than America's two close neighbors. So we are extremely exposed if you were to have a massive hike in tax of 25% as is being proposed.
Now, this interview took place on Thursday before we got the nod.
Perhaps one of the better outcomes would be that Ireland just remains lower on the radar screen. But if there were to be an event and he were to read some, you know, briefing note that says Ireland accounts for a quarter of the EU's entire budget trade surplus with the United States, perhaps out of the blue, a capricious man that he is, might say something or announce something. So, as I say, maybe the least bad option is that there isn't a meeting and Ireland remains lower on the radar screen so that something dangerous and damaging Ireland wouldn't be announced.
Bit late now. We're on our way. But let's leave that there for now and turn to the row that just won't go away. Speaking time in the Dáil. And the Dáil Reform Committee allocated new speaking slots to TDs supporting the government. Cue ructions. And then the opposition reacted by withdrawing its support for the pairing arrangement, essentially ending cross-party cooperation for voting. A move that Taoiseach described as disproportionate. The Taoiseach there went for childish. On Morning Ireland, Áine not pulling her punches. She put this to Fine Gael's Barry Ward.
Michael Lowry, who is the man who, engineered or helped negotiate the coalition that brought this government into being and gave it its majority. In 2011, Micheál Martin told the Dáil that Michael Lowry was an insidious and pervasive influence who'd engaged in cynical behaviour. And it was a non-contested all-party motion that voted, Dáil Éireann voted unanimously, Michael Lowry should resign. So why is this government, that's in 2011, in 2025, going to all this trouble? It's gone on for 6 weeks. Why go to all this trouble for a man that Dáil thought should have resigned in 2011?
Well, we're not going to all this trouble for that man or for any other independent TD. As I say, I'm here to represent the interests of 53 backbench TDs between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil who have no time at the moment. Now, last night we met in circumstances where one of the Sinn Féin TDs said that if we did not do what they wanted, all hell would break loose. Now, you cannot operate a democratic parliament under the threat of all hell breaking loose. That is not the way democracy operates. And I think the opposition, if they're going to throw their toys out of the pram again the way they did on the 22nd of January, need to think very carefully about whether we actually have a parliament that's going to function, do the business of the people, hold the government to account and deal with issues, or is there going to be the same theatrics that we saw in the trade?
And that is the question, Duncan Smith. Maybe to
And then, yes, this to Labour's Duncan Smith.
You were talking before the interview started about that AI-generated fantasy that Donald Trump tweeted yesterday about a golden Gaza. He's talking tariffs. He's accusing the EU of screwing the USA. Is this the time for the public to be watching politicians in Leinster House screaming and roaring at each other and holding up the Dáil's business? For instance, the committees that could be holding, you know, the Arts Council overspending to account right now.
Look, I had to cut short a speech on Ukraine, the third anniversary of Ukraine, yesterday to go to this meeting yesterday. As a new foreign affairs spokesperson for the Labour Party, I want to be speaking about Trump. I want to be speaking about the grotesque things that he is doing and the changing in the international order. But it is also important that we ensure that that our parliament functions in an accountable manner. And what Deputy Ward has stated there...
Being Trumpian in the way it's using its majority.
They are absolutely distorting how parliament is working now. What Deputy Ward is saying in terms of accountability is that government TDs are now going to be given the same right as opposition to hold their own government to account. I, unlike Deputy Ward, I've been in every meeting of this whole affair, including the meetings that had Deputy Michael Lowry in it. I know exactly what he asked for, unambiguously, on the meetings of the day that you tried to elect a Taoiseach. He wanted, for him and his group, leaders' questions, priority questions,
by
members'
business.
Is this
for Michael Lowry?
Yes, and they got it. What they forced through yesterday, and I know a number of the government members of that meeting yesterday didn't make any contribution, they're surely embarrassed. This is what Barry's doing this morning, is defending the indefensible on the national airwaves. And yeah, ultimately, we will have to move on and deal with the issues of the day, but not until such time that the opposition makes it clear that this is absolutely unacceptable, that this is a subversion of our accountability and our
that?
Parliament.
They have the majority.
Oy, oy, oy. For Morning Ireland. And that Dáil vote will not now take place until after St. Patrick's Day. So more to come. Back in a bit. Welcome back. We're going to have to play this. It was the RTÉ Radio 1 Folk Awards, Dublin's Vicar Street, Wednesday night. A barnstormer. And getting not one, but two awards, Roche. Best Original Folk Track and Best Emerging Artist. And when you hear her, you'll know why. Thank you. Roche, and we will have more from the RTE Radio 1 Folk Awards a wee bit later. And just how to follow that.
Yeah, right.
Are we on? Yeah.
This weekend is Oscars night. I'm joined by Dave Fanning.
Yeah, how's it going? Of course, no Irish interest in the Oscars this year. Yeah. We might as well be in the in memoriam section, Brendan.
We were having such a good run as well.
Yeah.
And it won't be the same without our Killian.
Killian Murphy, of course, yeah, very disappointing for Ireland this year. No Saoirse Ronan, no Gladiator. Two honours for Paul Mescal or the lads of the Balaclava. It's like we got kneecapped this year.
Jeez, right. But look, Killian didn't even get a nod in the sound category.
What?
And he's like pure sound.
Oh,
he's the soundest man there is.
Anyway, of course, Killian will be there because he's going to be presenting the Best Actress Award on the night itself.
Oh, yeah. Thank God. It kind of saves it, to be honest.
Does it, yeah.
Nothing like a bit of Cork presence, like.
But of course, he lives in Dingle now, doesn't he? Which means he probably prefers Kerry. I don't know about these things, but I'd say Killian prefers Kerry.
Keep my hero's name out of your effing mouth, or I'll Will Smith you, Dave.
Jeepers, H. Chris Rock. What? Yeah. Anyway, I'm praying that the winner of the Best Picture this year will be Conclave. Just a fantastic move with the papal voting.
Oh, yeah. Lots of red and white outfits in that film.
Yeah.
Maybe we could definitely claim that one for the Rebels.
What? Yeah. Unlikely contender, of course, is a complete unknown. Timothée Chalamet stars in the Bob Dylan biopic about Bob Dylan going electric at the Newport Folk Festival.
I don't get the fascination, you know. What about the time the Sultans of Ping nearly went acoustic at Cork Jazz?
What?
Where's that movie? Where's me movie? Where's me movie?
I can see why everyone's upset, though. Ireland really got used to Oscar success the last couple of years. We don't know what to do with ourselves now. It's like we're trying to cling to every little thing.
Exactly. Small things like these. I mean, Killian is a genius in that. Playing a sad Cork man who's sad because, like, he's trapped in Wexford instead of in the land that he loves. I presume. I just didn't look up the rest of the plot, like.
Yeah, not really.
Anyway, we're running out of time. All right, before we go, if you've been affected by anything you've heard on the programme, go to your fridge and drink a litre of Tanora. Right, we're done.
And on Continental Rifts, we heard from artist and writer John Graham and filmmaker Joe Lawler. Now, they'd both grown up in Finglas, and it was the arrival of the Fortin student in the summer and the of the exotic that first alerted them to the wider world.
You hosted, did you?
We hosted several, but the whole... Probably the same for you, Joe. We hadn't gone on any foreign holidays or we didn't have any direct experience of encountering people from elsewhere. So to encounter all these kids our own age from Spain was like, wow, there is a world out there and they smell nice.
And their skin was great, unlike our skin. And they were certainly cleaner. And maybe it was the kind of person that would come over. I don't know.
I'm not aware that there was any equivalent initiative kind of here where I guess we were busy learning Irish, you know. So maybe we were going to the Gaeltacht, I suppose. That was our equivalent. So kind of that language learning thing was a little bit more insular, a little bit more contained, right? It wasn't. We didn't reach into Europe in quite the same way.
No.
And to be an artist was an ambition they both had from an early age.
On the cover, Rubens, Rembrandt and Vermeer. And where it says Rembrandt, I've scribbled out the name Rembrandt and put John Graham in place. So obviously I had certain aspirations, even from that stage. And in a way, it was like their lives more than the things they made. The idea of being an artist. Whoever heard of that, you know.
And maybe to be that artist, you needed to move.
There's a nice quote which we have used in one of our films by Rebecca Solnit. In different places, different thoughts emerge. Mm. And it strikes me that sometimes you've got to force yourself to do a dramatic break. But sometimes it'll lead you to a particular point and you are going to have to jump. You're going to have to be brave and hang on to that and trust that it'll work out.
Filmmaker Joe Lawler and artist John Graham on Continental Rifts. Well, did you spot them? All seven planets, that is.
Mars, Jupiter, Uranus, Venus, Neptune, Mercury and Saturn.
Yep, it's called a planetary parade. And I do hope you caught it because it won't be around again until 2040. Frances McCarthy of Black Rock Observatory was on it. Of course she was.
I'm looking out of my window right now and looking at Venus in the sky. unmissable.
Oh.
Literally, if you're driving home, don't crash, but, you know, look up to the west and slightly to the south of west. So west is where the sun is going down. Look a little bit to the left of that and up a little bit. The honkingly bright one is Venus.
Okay.
Now, it is a parade of planets, but two or three of them are incredibly close to the horizon.
So I actually did look up there and I forgot.
You're inside.
Yeah. I forgot I was in a studio and there are no windows.
You can see, Francis, this is going to be a hopeless situation.
It's a bad start.
Okay. And particularly shy, Mercury.
There's two that you need a telescope, binoculars for, which are Uranus and Neptune. And we're joined by Mercury. Mercury is the one that is the holdout, because Mercury has the smallest orbit. It's zipping around the sun and it pops up for literally 3 or 4 days at a time. And then it's gone again.
Okay.
I hate Mercury and it hates me back. I've seen it 12 times ever. And this is going back to the 70s. Okay. I like astronomy. I love looking at planets, and just Mercury does not like me.
Okay. Well, if it doesn't like you, it definitely doesn't like me, Francis, I'd say.
Now, we might have to tell you that the full parade of planets might have shuffled off the sky stage at this point, but you'll still catch a good view, so get out there. It's pretty profound.
This is something that I think everybody feels. You go outside and you know your feet are on the ground, you're rooted onto this planet, and you can see our place in space. A clear night with the stars and the planets, you're transported beyond the Earth.
Pretty cool. But if all of that passed you by, don't worry. Just get yourself down to Kilkenny City, specifically St. Canice's Cathedral, and you will see the moon hanging inside. The creation of artist Luke Jarram. It's called Museum of the Moon.
The sculpture is 7 metres in diameter and it's all made out of NASA imagery. So it allows the public to get up close to the moon for the first time and see all the craters and the valleys and the mountain in perfect detail. Every centimetre on this sculpture, it's a giant sphere suspended in the nave of the cathedral. So this giant sphere, every centimetre represents about 5 kilometres on the moon's surface. So NASA have sent satellites right around the surface of the moon. So they've got all the imagery. And the great thing about NASA is they allow the public to use their imagery. So I got the imagery from NASA. And of course, the moon that we see in the sky only faces one way. We only get to see the front side of the moon. So this artwork allows the public to go all the way around the back and see the far side or the dark side of the moon for the first time as well. So that's really quite exciting for lots of people. In fact, a little girl came up to me at one of the exhibitions and she said, "Will you put the moon back afterwards?" So she thought I'd stolen the real moon. I thought that was rather cute.
Oh, it is. And it's also a good job she wasn't looking up when he made his very first moon.
The first moon I made was actually helium-filled and it popped live on BBC television. It was a complete disaster. So I had to sort of redesign it.
The whole moon
then,
popped.
It's been quite successful. Sorry?
The entire moon popped.
Yeah, it was designed to go outside. It went into a hot air balloon fiesta, but it was far too windy and it was all a bit of a disaster. It's the nature of doing new things a lot of the time is you have to be willing to fail, to take risks and learn from those failures when things go wrong and then get back on your horse and give it another go.
Wipe your tears, child. It's called resilience. And in case you were wondering, the moon packs up quite neatly, travel size even.
So this Museum of the Moon has been to, maybe 30 different countries all around the world. Last year, I took the moon to Kerala in India and 100,000 people turned up on one night to come and see the moon. It was completely crazy. And it's because the moon has massive significance in Hindu culture. So the moon has different significance in culture and religions all around the world. So it'll be really interesting to see, what people make of it in Kilkenny.
Just don't do what the Yanks did.
We did take it to America once and it came back with small holes in it. I think someone decided to try and shoot the moon, expecting it to sort of blow up dramatically like a something out of Hollywood. But of course, this moon artwork is air-filled, and so the bullet would have passed through the membrane of one side of the moon and popped out the other without too much fuss. But yeah, that's America for you. Hey?
All right, but presumably you're not wanting any of that kind of activity down in St. Thomas's. The people of Kilkenny, or maybe a slitter. And a hurley, they might come in to the St. Canice's. I hope none of that happens. I won't be giving them bad ideas.
Okay, Sheehy. From Arena, back in a bit. Welcome back.
What should I say there? I'd say it again. The other word, I was wrong.
I was wrong.
Ooh, sticks in the craw, doesn't it? And certainly not a phrase you hear too often, at least not on the radio. But in the context of a marriage or any LTR, it might just keep you together. Here's Richard Hogan with Brendan at the weekend.
They say a marriage is about compromise. Another key is probably to recognise that you can't always be right, is it?
As much as I want to be, Brendan.
Yeah.
We can't always be right. I suppose... You know, that's a really important part. What we're talking about here, you know, the old real estate thing, location, location, location. It's communication.
Okay.
That's what we're talking about. And is communication perfect? You know, are we perfect in our relationships? Are we perfect in our ideas and how we interact with each other? Absolutely not. Are we messy as human beings? We are very messy. Do we come from messy families ourselves? Yes, we do. And then we come from these systems that were messy, and we meet someone in the college bar or wherever we meet someone, walking down, this friend introduces us or whatever it is, we meet someone. And we come from these messy systems, and then we try to coherently make a story ourselves. And it's not always very coherent as a narrative goes to raise your kids or to be in a relationship. So allowing for that, you know, and understanding, of course, at times you're going to have to say, you know, I was wrong there. I mean, that's something I say to my daughter in a fight, an argument.
What should I say there?
I'd say it again. I'd say to my daughter, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I shouldn't have said that.
The other word, I was wrong.
I was wrong.
Yeah, I was wrong.
Parents don't often say that to children. No. I was wrong. No. It's not a sign of weakness. I'm just trying to show her that actually, you know what, sometimes I am wrong and sometimes it's good to argue with me. I mean, you know, I want her to be able to argue with me so I can say I was wrong about that. Yeah, I shouldn't have said that, or I shouldn't have done that. Maybe that was an overreaction. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, that's a very powerful phrase. I was wrong there. And thing is, you can throw it around like confetti as well. Like once you don't kind of, you know, once it's not, you're not allowing it to injure yourself. Right.
No, exactly.
I was wrong. It's costless. Like to
one of the greatest ways of resolving a conflict is that when you're defensive, you don't resolve it. When you say, look, you know, I was wrong there. I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Everything gets, you know, turned down a little bit.
But what if you're right? And while not quite wrong, for Ray, a sartorial step too far. Docks, specifically oxblood docks with yellow laces, do not ask. But Connor Pope was a yes.
By the way, can I take issue with Dr. Martin's comment there earlier on? You're not too old to wear docks.
Did I say I was too old?
You did.
All right,
and
okay.
I think a lot of people my age were listening to you going, I'm not that much older, younger than Ray.
Well, John O. Wexford has been on, I'm 65 and still wearing my Oxford Doc Martens. You're never too old. It's John O. Wexford, yeah. This is going to sound very odd, Connor, but I know you long enough to be able to say it. I don't like anything that draws attention to me.
Yeah.
And that's why
I maybe you're in the wrong job, Ray. I'm just going to put that out there, you know, the whole being on telly, the den.
I know.
DJing in Kildare when you were 19.
I know it's contradictory, but that's
no, but actually.
And later in the week, Ray spoke to Dr. Paul O'Callaghan from Middleton in Cork. His documentary is called Our Blue World, and it's narrated by Liam Neeson. So no muck there. And O'Callaghan is a water scientist who loves his subject.
It's an ode to water. And it is something that we take for granted, particularly in this country, I suppose, because we're just surrounded by it and it rains so often. We've so many lovely rivers. We're an island, all those things.
Yeah.
But just in a couple of sentences before we get into you and the documentary, the future of water. What is the future of water? I know that sounds like an odd question.
Well, look, we have too much of it and too little of it, right? So it's kind of paradoxical. Leonardo da Vinci used to talk about that. It can be give life, it can take life. We are running out of it, and at the same time, we sometimes experience an awful lot of it.
Yeah.
There's only so much of it in the world since the world began, like 4 billion years, not a single new drop. So we have what we have, and we constantly reuse it, and that's the beautiful thing about it. It regenerates itself, it never runs out, and it's what gives life to this planet and any place else in the universe that there will be life. We expect there'll be water.
And this documentary goes all over the world to explore our evolving views on our rivers and seas.
In New Zealand,
They have, this is a landmark judgment at the highest level of the highest court in New Zealand, where they've granted a river human rights. Am I reading that correctly?
You are. It's a funny idea, isn't it? You know, but we all think that a corporation has a right, like a personhood, and no one seems to question that, right? You could be sued by a corporation. Well, the Maori had this deep belief that they'd held for, you know, hundreds of years, that the river is alive. The river is like a person. And, you know, somehow we all kind of feel that. If you walk by a river, I mean, they have songs about them, stories. So their big victory was they kept campaigning until eventually they got politicians in New Zealand to listen to this and say, yeah, you know what, we'll enshrine that into our constitution. And now when we do things in the future, we're going to view the river like a person.
OK, so anything that's done that would affect the river has to, what has to happen?
Respect the rights of the river. They have a word in their language, te mana o te wai, which is like the health of the river, the river's life force. So they have to mine that life force in the river. And I think their great victory really was to keep that alive for hundreds and hundreds of years through music, song, their language. And so if they're doing any planning, they have to take into consideration what's it going to do to the life force of that river.
And of course, respecting our waterways is vital to ensure our own human way of life can survive. He talked about sponge cities. I'm sorry, pardon?
The very word sponge cities, people are, you're curious, aren't you?
Yes.
You're wondering, what's that mean? Well, I'd heard about these things. I'd been to China. I don't know if you've been to China.
I haven't been to China, no.
Well, the first time I went there, my abiding memory was it's full of concrete, the air is polluted, a lot of traffic. I'd heard about this guy, Kong Jianyu, and these sponge cities, and I was incredibly curious. They looked beautiful in photographs. The idea was you build your cities not to stop water from getting into the ground, but to hold on to it with trees, with ponds, with lakes, with wetlands. And when we went there, it was just after China opened up after COVID-19. We were the first film crew in there, and they're generally pretty suspicious about film crews going to China. But we had a very good story, I think, to share, which was Kong Jian had fought and fought against the government to say we shouldn't be doing what happened in the West. We shouldn't just build concrete everywhere. And then there was this huge flood in Beijing. And after that flood, the government changed their mind. And they said, OK, let's try this. Let's try this in one city. And they did. And now there's 50 cities all over China and it's spreading. And the thing is, they're beautiful. They're not like what you picture these cities like at all. Like you'd want to walk through them. Old people are there, young people are there. And it looks like a park, but when you know what you're looking at, it's really a constructed, engineered wetland. But nobody would ever really notice that unless you knew what you're looking for. Farmers in China for thousands of years, when they were building rice paddies, they always left a little bit of room because those mighty rivers, the Mekong, the Pearl River, the Yangtze, when they flood, it's catastrophic. So you've got to leave a bit of room for them. So there are ponds which hold the water, but they'll clean it and they'll purify the water. They'll cool the place down as well. Yeah. So it's a good thing to do in climate change.
Very interesting. Dr. Paul O'Callaghan with Ray, his documentary, Our Blue World. And that brings us to the garden and Marie Staunton and Catherine Carton with Claire. And we'd like to thank this particular listener for getting in touch.
Is it absolutely way too late to plant spring bulbs?
Asking for a friend.
Well, I've seen some in the garden centre. If you want it, I reckon you could try it if you wanted to do maybe pots. But they do have bulbs because I do love an old trip to the garden centre to have an old nosy. And there's loads of sprouted bulbs that are similar in size to the ones that's in my garden that I planted in autumn. Mm-hmm. So I'd say go for it, but don't do like a whole bed of it. But do
put them into pots and have them indoors. They'll come up much quicker. Mm. They're better in the ground or in pots than in your shed or garage.
I know, but if you forget, like this listener who bought them in September but forgot to plant
them
in
the bag.
So they're sprouting already. Yeah, probably.
Haven't said. They say, look, they say it might be a stupid question, but I haven't got green fingers, so I don't
get them in the ground.
There are no stupid questions. Nope.
No,
there are no stupid questions, and we all buy stuff and forget to use them. But you'd say put them into pots.
Put them in. Yeah,
you should
get them
be okay.
In.
Yeah.
On it. And Catherine is also a beekeeper.
So this was my first winter. And something I learned this winter, and your listeners, because once you see this, you can't unsee it.
So I hope they've had their breakfast.
So I hope you've had your breakfast. Yeah. If you have your clothes on the washing line today, especially if it's a white sheet, and if you see any little tiny dots that look like pollen, this actually is probably, this time of year, bee poop. So I learned that bees don't leave the hive over winter because it's too cold. So they won't come out of hive if it's like below 10 degrees-ish. And this time of year, Oh, also, they don't poop in the hive, so they have to hold it in. So they haven't left the hive December, January.
So they've been holding their poop for the whole winter.
And now they do a cleansing flight, is what it's called. That's the term. So you'll see them coming out of the hive and they just fly around, do their business, and you'll notice it on leaves. And this is honeybees as well, but obviously other bees will do it. But yeah, if you do notice specks on your windscreen or your washing line, and you're like, what is that? It's probably bee poop this time.
The bee has had a colonic.
Yes.
And it's out.
Does it come off?
Leaving it on the
sheet. Yeah, it'll come off. And do you know what? I didn't notice it. I obviously saw some outside of the hive. And then once I seen it, I was like, oh, actually.
That's what it is.
That's what that is.
Mm. Every day is a school day.
Every day is a school day. So a cleansing flight. So next time you need the loo, just say, I'm off on a cleansing flight.
And what's happening?
Never too classy for a poo joke. And kids, if you're listening, of course you are, growing our RT Radio 1 demographic, you will love this next bit. Captain Underpants Dogman with Oliver, their creator, Dave Pelkey. He's massive, but for the uninitiated...
Well, the plot of Captain Underpants revolves around two boys named George and Harold, and they're very much like I was when I was a kid. They're just goofballs, and they have ADHD like I did. They're always making comics and stories and getting in trouble. And so that turns into... They end up hypnotizing their principal and turning him into a superhero named Captain Underpants.
And from this grew Dogman.
When I was a child, when I was writing Dogman stories, he was basically a regular dog who kept getting struck by lightning for some reason. It's just kid logic. And so now it's more of a RoboCop origin story, but it's still, I think, in the vein of something that a kid would come up with and think that was possible.
It's the head of a dog.
On the body of a man, yes.
And all of these creations started when Pilkey was just a kid growing up in Cleveland, Ohio.
I was diagnosed with ADHD, actually before it even existed. I was diagnosed as an adult, but as a child, I was diagnosed with what they called extreme hyperactivity. And so,
which is a symptom of ADHD.
Yes, that's right.
We're close, but we're quite there.
Yeah, so I was always getting in trouble at school. I couldn't really control my behavior. I was out of my seat all the time. So my teacher would send me out into the corridor, and that's where I started creating my stories.
Really? And it was literally you couldn't sit still in the room and you were put outside the door.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was separated from my classmates, and I missed the camaraderie. And so the one way I had a connection with my friends in the classroom was to draw these stories that I would bring back in and show them. And actually, that was the beginning of Dogman and Captain Underpants when I was in year two. I was 8 years old.
But as you might imagine, his teachers did not always appreciate his oeuvre. In fact, they really didn't like them.
I gather one teacher took it a bit further and thought that maybe you were possessed by something. Did that happen?
That did happen, yeah. And in my, I went to religious school. My father was a pastor. He's passed away. But my mother is a church organist, and so I grew up in religious schools. And this was in the 1980s during what they call the Satanic Panic, and they were. a couple of my teachers thought I might be possessed, and they performed an exorcism on me.
What age are you?
I would say I was probably 12.
Were you able to kind of laugh at this, or was it quite
terrifying? No, I was terrified. It took a lot of thinking, and I kept going through it in my head. But for many years, it resulted in some nightmares and just trouble sleeping, just really some anxiety issues. But for the most part, I talked my way out of it. I thought, you know,
really?
I think the positive influence. My parents didn't know that happened. I didn't come home from school and tell on myself. So they didn't know that was going on. But they were such. I always had a safe environment when I came home from school.
Yeah. Did they ever find out about that?
They did. Yeah. Oh, eventually they did. Yeah.
When you're an adult and recovered from it. Did you believe them at the time when they were performing the exorcism? Because you're 12 years old.
I did. I did at the time, yeah, because that's I went to that school and that's what everyone was talking about, and I didn't really know any better because that's the world I was in.
And Dave Pilkey was the loveliest of interviewees, responding to text from kids, taking on questions about the spelling in his books, it improves as his characters learn more, and explaining his own lack of an E. You spell his name D-A-V.
When I was a teenager, I worked at Pizza Hut, and they were making a name tag for me, and they were using one of those old-fashioned leather label makers, and the E was broken. So it just printed out D-A-V, and that stuck.
That's it for...
Dave Pilkey, no E. Now we are almost at a finish here on Playback, but it is to the RTE Radio 1 Folk Awards we will return. And Donal Lunny, this year's recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award. From Plangstee to the Bothy Band to Moving Hearts and so many others, Lunny is one of the most significant figures in folk and trad music ever to come out of our country. He took to the stage at Vicar Street.
My whole sort of reason for living was playing music, enjoying it, and just meeting people and playing. So I was successful in that. It was brilliant. I got a chance to circulate and to meet loads of people I loved. But one of the important factors in that was that I got to be MD on a series called Bringing It All Back Home, which Philip King pulled me into. And through that, I met people from not just all over Ireland, but all over America. And went on from there to do Salt, which is also Philip and Noel O'Connor. And that was another sort of opportunity to meet great people, and to play with them. So I can't complain in that regard. I've just had an amazing run of it. So, I'm so delighted to be here tonight. And it's...
And then he played. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.